In this part of the show, we'll be talking with economist Gar Alperovitz. Back in 2005, he said that the time was ripe for a popular movement focused on inequality, and certainly today's Occupy movements have proven him right. He argues that this kind of activism, this thing that is happening all over the country at a very local level, has the potential to change the entire country in some very big ways. In this hour, we will talk about some of the ideas that you will find in his book, America Beyond Capitalism, which is really an updating of an earlier book. The subtitle is Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. It is published by the Democracy Collaborative Press. It's in paper. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore. The book profiles some citizen experiments that are now underway that go beyond traditional economic models to democratize wealth and empower communities. And we'll be talking about some of those things in this part of the show. Questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go ahead to anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. Email is possible, too. You can write us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Our guest is Professor of Political Economy at University of Maryland. He's also the co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative and is author of a number of books, including the one we're talking about here, America Beyond Capitalism. And Professor Alperovitz, hello. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And we certainly, I'm glad that you could be with us. Back in 2000, as I mentioned, sort of this benchmark is now back in 2005. You were talking about how we were at the time where you could see there we would have a popular movement focused on this particular issue, and that was before the banking crisis, before the downturn in the economy, certainly before Occupy. And I suppose one of the questions one might ask is, you know, what took us so long? Why did it take 6 years before it actually materialized?
Well, I think I was at that point looking at the kind of structural logic that was building up. I called it a little off. I said it would be either the top 1% of the 99%, or maybe it was the top 2%. So I didn't hit it quite on. As the 99% to one, I had 99 or 98. The development was growing inequality dramatically at the top. And the trend, if you look at the long trend we saw over the last three decades, the percentage of income by the top 1% had gone from just about 10%, and it peaked at about 24%. Now, it's bobbled around a bit below that because of the recession. But over that time, that meant that as it went from 10% to 24%, the bottom 99% lost that amount from 10 to 14% of income. In fact, most wages were flat have been flat, roughly speaking, tiny variations for the last 30 years. Hmm. And obviously, it seemed to me something had to give. That was at the economic level. But there was another crisis building up. Quite apart from unemployment and stagnation, I think there's been a long-term, you can only call it a political moral crisis building up. 35 years ago, if you asked people in surveys, do you believe in democracy? Does the government do what the people say? And three-quarters of the people would say, well, yes, the government basically does what the people want it to do. That's changed dramatically at the same time over 30 years as the income distribution has changed. If you ask that question now, what you'll get is almost entirely reversed. They'll say, oh, no, it does what the big corporations do or what the politicians do. There's a loss of belief, and this is truly fundamental, that we really have a democratic system. People sort of think, yes, well, vote in an election. But at another level, there's a sense that really something's wrong in Washington. Big corporations, lobbyists, big bankers, there is a process underway that violates very fundamental American ideas about democracy. And you put that together with the economic change, and I think that's the beginning of what really is a systemic crisis, not just an ordinary political problem. It points to deep, deep structural problems in our system.
And I'm really interested, and you could talk about this some more, and your argument that because of that, and that the place that we are now in history, in the time that we are, is very important, is very interesting, is certainly difficult, and that maybe more than there's never been in American history a time quite like this.
I think that's right. I think this is one of the most, maybe the most important time in American history, bar none. And it's very important just to think about that question and struggle with it. The reason I say that is I think the economy has been in long-term difficulty for really at least a century, and that we're running out of the kind of easy answers that we've been able to, quite by chance in most cases, been able to use to solve problems. Obviously, this is a long discussion, and to oversimplify it, there were crises throughout the 19th century that in some way, you know, you could always go west, young man. There was more land available to solve at least personal problems. Workers could move out onto a farm or just that was an available option. Now, that closed down when the frontier closed down at the end of the 19th century. And in the first quarter of the 20th century, and again, I'm oversimplifying for, you know, quick, we could go into
sure,
it.
Sure.
The economy was in great trouble leading up to World War I, which essentially bailed us out and solved the economic problem. We don't know what would have happened if a crisis had deepened in 1913 and 14 as was developing. But the first quarter of a century, you know, the war, quite by chance, I think, solved that problem. Certainly in the second quarter of the century, the massive problem of the economy, the Great Depression, was not resolved by the New Deal. Some very good things happened during the New Deal. But as most economists and historians understand, it was, again, a massive global crisis, World War II, that solved that problem. And again, to oversimplify slightly, the third quarter of the century, for one thing, World War II destroyed our competitors for a while. They did come back, and then the problems began again, but also the Korean War, the Cold War, the Vietnam War, military spending much higher, 14% of the economy during the Korean War, help stabilize things even as the competitors slowly came back. I think those answers, for better or worse, and fortunately I think for better, war is a terrible thing, that even with the large defense budgets, they are much smaller now. They're in the 4 to 5% range of the economy, and that sort of easy way to boost the economy is over. And that means either we work out political decision-making that is rational and intelligent to manage the economy, or we may very well be in the doldrums for and great difficulties for a long, long time, both economic and also inequality and poverty and environmental. Our political decision-making process is, you know, people say Washington is broken, and I think there's some truth to that. There's something really wrong that doesn't solve these large-order problems that we really for the first time have to face directly. I don't think, you know, because of nuclear weapons, basically, we're not going to have big, big, big wars, I think. Thank God for that. But I think we're now up against having to come to terms with the that we either manage this. You know, this is a very rich economy. If you broke it up today, it's well over $190,000 for every family of four is being produced. Our problems are that politically, we can't seem to manage it. There are structural, deep, deep structural political power problems that are blocking an intelligent way to manage this very rich and generous economy.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Gar Alprovitz. He's professor of political economy at University of Maryland, co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative, the author of a number of books, and some of the ideas here we're talking about this morning you will find in his book, America Beyond Capitalism, which is an updating of an earlier book, published this new version published by the Democracy Collaborative Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So here we find ourselves being in this place where, economically speaking, we are at a time of both decay and stagnation. And the question is, well, okay, so where do we go? Where do we go for answers? And if the kind of economic system that has long been embraced and supported by, generally speaking, by conservatives, has gotten to us to this point where we have this extreme income inequality and people feel that they don't have any voice in politics at all. If they turn to the left, some people would say, I think maybe you would say, is that on the left, they don't exactly have the answer either, or at least it's not going to be, you know, the avenue to to influence the system that was there in the past is not there anymore.
Right. Well, that's the that's the challenge of and why I wrote America Beyond Capitalism. I come out of I'm from right around your part of the woods. I'm from Racine, Wisconsin, a kind of difficult, struggling industrial town just a little bit north of where you are. And I come out of the Wisconsin progressive tradition. I managed House and Senate staffs, legislative staffs, and worked at high levels of the government in various forms. So I came out of the tradition that offered at least a liberal or progressive solution to the problems. What's really interesting to me as a historian, quite apart from that professional role of years back, I was Gaylord Nelson's legislative director, the founder of Earth Day. Quite apart from that, the muscle or the political institutional power that made the kind of balancing of corporate power possible, that is, in the traditional balance between corporate design and progressive strategies, the power base of that was the labor union movement, not only on the shop floor, but in all of the advanced industrial societies. The, quote, system was run by sort of balancing off the political power of labor and its allies against corporations and then trying to come to terms with a fair understanding and a new strategy. Well, labor unions have declined from their post-war peak from roughly 35%, 34.5% in the early post-war period. They're now down at 11% and declining, and in the private sector down to 6-7%. So the traditional answer to the, quote, system problem in throughout the West and even in Japan has been enough of a power base to balance corporate power in politics as well as economics and come up with a management that worked for the overall system. That's over. For better or worse, that whole structure of progressive politics, and I support that direction personally, I come out of that tradition, it has lost its fundamental historical power base. That means that, and I think now it's not just about one election or the next election, which may take one person in or another person out. It's about the capacity to organize a legislative program, an economic program, a powerful social process, and environmental policy. All of that weakens. It is a systemic weakening. And unless there is a new direction beyond that, the direction is domination by large corporations, which have a very different program. That's an implicit institutional power base than the society as a whole. And I think that's where we are. And I want to emphasize that we're thinking here about big, long change, the kind of change that builds up over decades. If there is a new way forward, yes, there are very important things to do day by day in politics. But unless over time we simultaneously build new institutions that offer a foundation for a new politics that can manage the system, I think we're in real trouble. Fortunately, and as I report, I mean, one of the other reasons I wrote America Beyond Capitalism is the press doesn't report on a very powerful development going on throughout the country in terms of new institutions that change who owns wealth. And I'll mention one, we probably come back to it. Mm-hmm. There are 13 million people involved in companies that are owned by the workers, democratizing ownership. Instead of the top 1%, the workers own these companies. Or there are 130 million people involved in co-ops or credit union co-ops. Again, democratizing ownership rather than concentrating it. And there's a vast underground of that development, which I think is growing because of the pain levels, and I think is potentially one element in a new structure that says, no, we want to move beyond simply the two kind of phony choices of American capitalism versus, quote, socialism, whatever that might mean. There's an American spirit at work, which is, and again, I'm a historian, and I think of these things as decade by decade, the kind of decades that in cities and towns and so-called, Justice Brandeis called the states the laboratories of democracy, they laid down experience and experiments and developments throughout the country in the decade-by-decade development before they became national kind of New Deal programs. The same thing happened in many other periods of American history. So when I think about change, I think, yes, the elections, but also what's really happening is much more important than the slow, quiet institutions that, the press doesn't cover and aren't reported on that may allow a foundation for a much more positive future.
Yeah. And I have a call I want to get right to, but just to sort of to underline something, I want to make sure that people understand it well. On the one hand, that you were criticizing the fact that, drawing attention to the fact that we have a lot of problem here that goes to the fact that the wealth, the capital, the political power in this country is concentrated in the hands of big corporations and also in a small number of individuals. What you are not saying, however, is that the alternative should be to concentrate capital and power in the state. You're also saying, no, we don't want to do that either.
That's exactly the argument. Thank you for clarifying that. I think we've been somehow forced to choose intellectually that there's really only two models of state socialism, where the commissars have control of everything and they control freedom and democracy, or corporate capitalism. You know, this is not free market capitalism anymore of the 19th century. It's corporate-dominated capitalism. Those aren't the only two choices. Why do we need to be narrow? And one of the things I try to suggest in America Beyond Capitalism is there are other alternatives that we can build that come right out of the American experience and make sense to, as I say, in my hometown, they make sense in Racine, Wisconsin. And if they don't, they better make sense in Racine, Wisconsin, where I come from, or any city, or they're not going to go anywhere. So I think there is a decentralized, you know, America is one of the most decentralized political systems in the world. We're not like France, which is highly centralized. I think there is a potential to build upon our decentralist community and state tradition. And also, there obviously is a need for national policy, but it could be based on a radically decentralized rebuilding of the base for the base up of democratic ownership. And I mentioned these co-ops and worker-owned companies that are, you know, millions of them. There are 5 or 6 million more people involved in worker-owned co-ops than there are unions in the private sector. But the press doesn't tell you about what's actually going on developing, and that's the basis of the kind of projected long-term hope that I may have for beyond where we now are.
We have some callers. Let's get them into the conversation. And we'll start with someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Very interesting conversation, especially since I just had dinner with a young, actually South Korean advocate of the local currency movement. And I thought I would just ask you whether things like that play into the scenario that you're trying to build, or whether you specifically know about local currency, how places have implemented it, and how this fits into to this equation that you're talking about. I'm going to ring off and listen on my radio. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Well, that is a very interesting question. I have not myself spent a great deal of time working on this problem, but it is one. There are many, many cities now in which there is a development of a so-called local currency, and very productively. For instance, the one I know best is in the Berkshires in western Massachusetts, where essentially the stores and the businesses and the banks have agreed to accept a local denominated piece of paper, which is a currency. They call it the Berkshire, and they will accept it in their own stores. It's a way of recirculating and rebuilding the local economy. And in fact, they give discounts in many places for using local, buying from local merchants and buying from local businesses. And I think that is that's not a long-term solution, but it is one element that tells you about this community-building way of thinking about the economy. And that's part and parcel of a vision of an America beyond capitalism. That is to say, all right, we're here in the Berkshires or in Racine, Wisconsin, or in good parts of the South and Midwest or Cleveland, Ohio. Either do we have to bribe, literally with large tax benefits, some company to come in, which is almost certainly going to leave at a certain point. We know this history very well. And for the most part, the studies show they would have come anyway because they don't come. They're just playing governors off for tax arrangements. Is that the only choice? Or can we rebuild from the bottom up and begin to take charge of our own future and then build a politics to support that? Local currencies are one part of that as people are searching for new answers. There are many, many others that we probably will have time to talk about, which are much larger in scale and are much more powerful already at this stage of development as well.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is Champaign County, here where we are, line two. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to mention that Mr. Professor Alberowitz, your contribution to the E.F. Schumacher conference recently, relatively recently, is available in its entirety on YouTube. It's quite a good viewing, and people could familiarize your arguments. Probably not as good as reading your book, but better than maybe a talk show where you get interrupted by people like me. But
thank you.
I wanted you to comment further on this sort of co-op movement phenomena and other things like people trying to re-municipalize basic city services. There was a movement here in Urbana to try to municipalize the water service, which is now owned by a German-English corporation. But you get stymied by at the state level quite quickly, it seems. So those kind of aspects. But also I wanted you to reflect on something from Germany. It's not part of the democratic socialist tradition, I don't think, but it sort of seems like it's a grassroots movement from the way I've seen it portrayed, which is they do have the subsidy for solar panels at the federal level, but quite a bit of the new electric production installed by alternate means in Germany is actually owned by municipalities, small groups, neighborhood associations, and things like that. And I really would like to see that somehow fostered. And like I say, one of the things you need is a cooperative system that doesn't cater to the ones that want to keep the huge centralization systems that are existing now. So I guess that's good fodder. I appreciate your work.
Great. Thank you very much. Just to mention, this is the 100th year for folks who know about E.F. Schumacher, the author of a wonderful book in the 1970s, all over the world, E.F. Schumacher's Small is Beautiful. That's available. If people were able to spell my name, they could find it easily on the tube or my website. But it's Alperovitz, Alperovitz. And it goes into this in more depth. So thanks for mentioning that. Look, the decentralization process is going on all over the country. And as I mentioned earlier, the press partly doesn't have much interest in it, but most important, I don't think they don't have the resources, the newspaper press, to really research it and cover it. Fortunately, the Internet is beginning to cover it, but the kind of things we're talking about are really quite common. You can find them anywhere in the country, and if you can do it in the Berkshires, or we'll talk probably about Cleveland, which is really very interesting city, but a very, very difficult city in terms of pain and social and economic dislocation. But if you can do it there or in other cities that are doing local co-ops doing energy installation and solar, you can do it anywhere. So let me mention a website that gives information on this. It's community-wealth. Community-wealth. Put the dash in. .org, and you'll find it simply surveys what's going on around the country at the local level, and it's just a useful tool. So I think if you look at what the kinds of things that we're talking about, for instance, most people don't realize that 25% of American electricity generation today, even now, is municipally owned or co-op owned. So that's a powerful segment of the economy, 25%, is already democratized in terms of electricity production. So it's different in different states. Some places it's easy to set up co-ops. Some places it's harder. Some places the municipalization is very, very difficult. In some places it may be easier. But that's not the only strategy available. So there are solar installation companies that are co-ops that can recapture some of this funding. There are ways to do in many parts of the country, different kinds of industries, as again we can talk about which ones, that are democratically owned. There are credit unions that exist. You can move your money from a big bank to a credit union. About $4.5 billion was moved in the last month or so. And more than that, moreover, that's a democratized system. You can actually get active and start making sure that the credit union doesn't become bureaucratized These are all the kinds of strategies and many, many more going on around the country. And you have to find the ones that are the best starting place for your own area. But rolling up your sleeves is the first name of the game. And number two is to learn what other people are already doing. And you'd be surprised at what can be done.
Yeah. There's so much we can talk about. And I definitely would like to hear you talk about maybe some specific things going on. And City of Cleveland provides some good case studies. And we can go on to that. You just said something that touched off in my mind one of the questions that I wanted to ask. And that is, you make the point of the fact that now we have millions of Americans who are in co-ops or in credit unions or worker-owned companies, and that's really significant. As you point out, there are more people in worker-owned companies than there are people in unions. But I guess that one of the questions you'd have to ask is, well, that's great, but what do you do to make sure that these kinds of things, the co-ops, the credit unions, these companies, don't eventually end up in their values and their structure just like conventional companies? And how do you keep, if you decide when you're starting out that there are a certain set of principles that are important to you and a way of doing things, how do you make sure that as time goes along, you maintain those principles?
Well, that's a wonderful question. And it goes again to what I'm calling the systemic problem, not just the important, very important developments and experiments on the ground, which are step-by-step development process. Let me back off and come at the question, which I like the question very much, from a different perspective.
Okay.
The historically, political economic systems are really characterized above all by who owns the productive wealth of the nation. So, very simply, in the feudal times, the lords owned the capital, mainly land, and they then had the political power. In sort of ordinary, traditional, competitive capitalism, the 19th century version, businessmen, farmers, because the farmers were businessmen selling in the market, unlike peasant farmers in Europe. That was a very decentralized vision of who had the power and who had the capital. Decentralized, and that was a form of democracy that was far more meaningful. In the socialist vision, and the most commonly known, the state owns the capital, and we know some of the consequences of that. Well, the alternative possibility that's presented now, I think, in our own very big and very decentralized country, is to build up democratizing the ownership of capital. Let me underline that. 1%. We talked about income distribution earlier. That's just income. But 1% owns just under 50% of the investment capital. That's the businesses, the factories, the farms, the stores, the minerals, the mines. 1%. 5% owns 70% of the investment capital. That's extreme. It is medieval, and I don't mean that I mean that technically. That's how medieval society was organized. We don't quite realize it. So if there is to be a democracy, somehow we're going to have to democratize the key ownership. These developments, the worker-owned companies, and with it a democratic spirit. So we can talk about many, many things. Worker ownership is one. The question of neighborhood ownership, the question of municipal ownership, state ownership, different forms of democratic ownership are important. But unless that is brought forward, just as you point out, with a cultural and political spirit that what we're talking about is not just experiments and not just businesses. What this is about is redemocratizing America. The name of the book is America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. It's not just about these economic institutions. So I think the next politics, and remember I come at this as a historian, year by year, how do politics build up over decades? Unless it brings with it the spirit of democratizing, of making co-ops democratic rather than bureaucratic, of making worker-owned companies democratic rather than highly controlled by a small group, that takes intention, and it takes doing it and finding out how to do it. And fortunately, there are a lot of examples. It also takes training and learning. Fortunately, there are lots of examples around the country where just that sort of thing is taking place, that people are self-consciously not just doing, let me underline this, self-consciously not just doing a, quote, project, or not simply setting up a worker-owned company. Rather, self-consciously beginning to see that what we're talking about is historical change, and really self-consciously trying to aim at the moral qualities, the democratic culture, and saying the idea really is, can we come to the place the way the women's movement did, the civil rights movement did, the environmental movement did, the first parts of the abolition movement did, the people who created the American Revolution, saying self-consciously, what this is about is a society in grave difficulty, and that self-consciously we are interested in building over time, prudently, carefully, and against very high odds, the next system that is none of the above. That means taking your question very seriously and looking to how the culture of these institutions changes at the same time the structure changes, and building from the ground up. Two ways to kind of frame that again. My heroes, and I write about this in America Beyond Capitalism, my heroes are the civil rights workers in the 1930s and 40s, not just the 60s, who understood you had to lay the groundwork for what might come next. Or again, if you look at the women's movement in the 19th century, it took them decade after decade after decade, state by state by state, until finally they accumulated enough power to transform the system and passed the amendments to the Constitution allowing women to vote. That's the process, and that really requires, you can't do that on economics alone. The only way that that kind of process goes anywhere is with a vision that informs it, that is a democratic, cultural, and political vision, that it's about democracy, not simply about this worker company or that co-op.
Our guest in this hour of focus is historian, political economist Gar Alperovitz. We'll talk some more in just a moment. First, we'll take a short break. This is Focus.
The FX series Justified begins its third season next week. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Timothy Oliphant, who plays U.S. Marshal Raylan Givens. And he'll tell us about his work on other shows, including Deadwood, The Office, and Damages. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by the Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, located in Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, with 10 different topics each week. On Monday morning, we'll have a couple of shows from the archives. They're both about the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King. Back live Tuesday with two of our how-tos, Scott Spies in the first hour with home care. The second is lawn and garden care. Wednesday at 10, we'll talk with Alex Shekar. He teaches creative writing here at the U of I, and we'll be talking about his new novel, Luminarium, which is a very interesting story about religion, about mystical experience, about what that is and where it comes from. And then also we'll talk on Wednesday at 11 with Dr. Steve Cohen. He's the senior fellow in foreign policy at the 21st Century Defense Initiative, and we will be talking about current events in Pakistan. He's been someone who's been following the politics of India and Pakistan for a long time, was for many years a professor of political science here at the University of Illinois, and helped to start the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security here. So you can check the schedule, listen to past programs by going to our website, which is will.illinois.edu. In this hour, our guest is Gar Alperovitz. He is a professor of political economy at University of Maryland. He is co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative, the author of many books, including the book America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, Our Democracy, and that is published in paper by the Democracy Collaborative Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free. 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. So back to another caller here. We have someone who's been patient, and they're in Champaign. We'll talk with them. They're on line one. Hello.
Yes. Yes, sir. I'm so glad. I'm in the Occupy movement, and I'm grateful for your book that has come out now. You talk about democratic vision, which is so important. Right now, Urbana is in the process of making the control of utilities more democratic. And what I'm hoping for, and tried to make some connection with my son out in San Francisco, who knows all about this, encouraging them in Urbana to start doing solar and wind power, go beyond the electric, so that we can get ourselves removed from the oil companies. I just wonder what you think the potential is in our community for this to happen. Thanks.
Well, I don't know the details of what's going on in Urbana, but it sounds to me like the direction you're going is exactly the right one. What I like very much about what you mentioned and the question, and my hat's off to you and the Occupy movement, is, you know, what it requires is learning. It requires activism, requires protest, but it also requires learning exactly what can be done, how to do it, and putting forward a really intelligent plan that makes sense. And what's wonderful about the current period, and again, I write about it in America Beyond Capitalism, but that website, community-wealth.org, covers it. There is an enormous amount of experience, and your son may have access to more of it. But I suspect you could pull together folks in the Occupy movement, sympathizers, professors at the university, and really put something on the table that says, hey, this is a better way to do it. It's going to save money. It's going to save energy. It will build a public spirit. It'll build a public institution. And then you've got something concrete to talk about. The ball always comes back to us. That is, if we want to do it, we need to sit down and get really serious about it in a way that puts forward a concrete plan. As I said, we've come back to Cleveland. But that's what's so exciting about some of the efforts around the country, is that we're no longer just rhetoric or just politics. It's people saying, hey, there's a better way to do this. We know that we've done our homework. I remember, and this is part of this, part of my own experience. I'm from Wisconsin, as I mentioned earlier, and I was involved in the anti-war movement in the Vietnam War era. And, you know, at the beginning of that time, nobody was challenging the government and the State Department's position in favor of the war. But as time went on, you know, someone from the State Department would come out to a little town in Wisconsin or Massachusetts, and, you know, a housewife would stand up, and the State Department representative would give the usual public line, whatever it was, and that woman had done her homework, and chapter and verse, she could back them down on the facts. I think we've got the facts. I think that there are the solar, for instance, the energy issues, yeah, go in our direction, but doing the homework and putting a concrete plan on the table, that's okay, the way to build.
Thanks.
All right. And I do think what's interesting here, and the caller makes me think about the fact that for a lot of the people who do have this critique of the economic system that we have now and who are talking about wanting to do something else, that they have a certain set of values that go with that, that have to do with the way you think about economics. But they're also, it seems to go hand in hand with a set of values that have to do with sustainability.
Yes.
And in the environmental sense. And that's also an important part of this as well, and a way in which maybe this kind of movement that we're seeing now is a little bit different from economic movements like this that we've seen before.
Absolutely, and indeed, I'm involved in I'm involved on the board of the New Economics Institute, which is attempting to bring that at one level of that, one part of that. But my book, as you know, America Beyond Capitalism, has a preface by a man named Gus Speth, James Gustav Speth. He's and it's very interesting because Gus is a very eminent insider, former insider environmentalist. He was a special advisor to President Carter and special advisor to President Clinton on environmental matters, dean of the Yale Law School of Environment and Forestry, head of the World Development Forum at the UN. And he's come to the conclusion, as an environmentalist, worried about growth and climate change, that you can't do it simply the old way. we have to do whatever we can in regulations and restrictions. But there's a systemic problem that you need to change the system or you can't do much. Now, you can build from the bottom up, but unless there's a direction that moves towards really systemic change of some kind, and I try in America Beyond Capitalism to say there are alternatives. We aren't forced to choose just between the corporate capitalism and state bureaucratic socialism. But having you need to deal with the big issues as well as building from the bottom up. And that's coming, I think, a whole part of the environmental movement is moving in that direction. Part of it hasn't, but part of it is moving, and I think we'll continually go deeper and deeper into that particular terrain. And I think that's very exciting and very important in the era of growth. We're going to have to limit growth and deal with climate change. That means you're really dealing with systemic problems.
All right. We'll go to line number two for another caller. This is Champagne. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Mr. Alperovitz mentioned the increasing, indeed accelerating, concentration of wealth in this country over the last 3 years, so that now we have a 1% or indeed a fraction of 1% owning almost a majority of productive property in this in the country. Does he think that that 1% or fraction thereof is going to give up control of that property voluntarily?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I'm not sure. I come at this out of real world politics. That is to say, I was involved in the House and the Senate and legislative campaigns for congressmen and senators from Wisconsin. A long period of so I at least have an inkling of what he's talking about. The answer is no. But on the other hand, I see these matters historically, and I think what's happening in the country, and you know, you never know about the future. I think what's happening in the country is that the pain levels are growing. The sense that we don't really have a democracy, that money is really dominating politics, that corporations and lobbyists and Wall Street bankers are dominating things, I think lots of people are beginning to get that. But I look at this as a historian, and I'll repeat it again in a different form. System change is about building from the bottom up slowly, steadily, and getting more and more awareness and development. And also unexpected things happen. The Middle East exploded one day. Occupy exploded one day. The kids who sat down at those lunch counters in the civil rights movement didn't know they were touching a match to an explosion. People for years, you know, you think we face difficulties. The civil rights workers in the 1930s and 40s were easily hung from a tree or perhaps tortured and then hung from a tree for raising political issues, and yet they overcame over time. Same can be said for the American Revolution. So I'm a long-term, prudent optimist. It may be that nothing can be done. It may be that the power relations never change. On the other hand, if you do nothing, they certainly won't change. And history suggests that as pain levels grow and as discontent grows and as knowledge, and the Internet helps us here, of the way things are is spread further and further, people have a way of getting standing up and beginning to demand something different over time. I'll give you two more examples. So I think that's what we're into. And I think that for people who care, that's the perspective that has some hope in it. And as a historian, I would say a substantial hope over time, given the pain levels and the failures, of moving slowly and steadily towards a different vision. You know, we all have a vested interest in pessimism. If you're pessimistic, you say nothing can be done, that takes you off the hook. All you got to do is sit back and, you know, enjoy whatever you're doing, because obviously nothing can be done. We know from history that very often that's a mistake. I'll give you one further example, and then, you know, I'll stop talking. I talked a little too much in this discussion. I grew up in the 1950s in Wisconsin. And as you know, Joe McCarthy dominated politics in the 1950s, anti-communist. But in Wisconsin, where I lived, they shot anything that moved politically. The teachers were scared. Local politicians were scared. Nobody would. And if you said in Wisconsin in the 1950s, I think there could be a major progressive change, let's do it, people would look at you as if you were crazy. But then, of course, the 60s exploded out from under that. So I'm a little skeptical about people who say nothing can be done or the power system is really inevitably going to control things, and maybe so. But the argument of this book, either as a historian or existentially, as one person to another, the only way forward is to try to build. And there's a lot in history that suggests, and there's a lot going on the ground that isn't covered by the press, that suggests that we may very well build the basis of a very positive and, you know, it's a very rich and wonderful country that should be maximizing democracy and liberty and ecological sustainability. This is not a poor country, as I said earlier. Even now in the recession, the economy is producing well over $190,000 for every family of four. We could have a wonderful society if we were able to manage our affairs, I think, more thoughtfully.
We just have a couple of minutes left. I want to thank the caller. I want to get one more. Spring Bay, line four. Hello.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I don't want to turn this partisan because, frankly, I don't see a lot in either party these days. But something you said earlier struck me. You were talking about regulations. And so the Republicans talk a lot about we've got to deregulate. And I'm thinking to myself, well, what they're really talking about here is a deregulation of oil and gas and a deregulation of the financial services, two things I think that really we need to look at very carefully. So that's just those two specifics. They don't ever talk specifically about what kind of deregulation they want to do, but it seems to me that's what's at the heart of it. And I'll get off and listen offline. Thanks. It's
okay.
A great show.
Thank you.
Also, environmental deregulation would be in there, and many others. Yes, I think that is what's at stake, and I think that path is, I think, not only wrong, but I think disastrous, because I don't know many experts, left, right, and center, are already predicting another financial crisis, because the lobbyists have undermined already, found loopholes and other ways to undermine the Dodd-Frank legislation on the financial sector. And the folks in Wall Street are back doing what they had done just before the last crisis. And I think we're going to have more crises of that kind. I also think ultimately, the chief economist of Citicorp, one of the biggest of the big banks, he was very frank. He said, and the public keeps bailing us out. We ought to be public banks. And I think, there is a big public bank in North Dakota already there for 90 years. And many, I think 14 states are thinking about setting up public banks. I suspect we're going to see some sort of public banks when these crises continue. We just nationalized General Motors and Chrysler, and after bailing them out and putting a lot of money into them, we gave them back. Taxpayers paid a big share of the cost and gave them back to other folks. I suspect we're going to even have some of those in public, maybe making mass transit vehicles and high-speed trains at some time in the future. But the regulation process is thoroughly, thoroughly riddled with lobbyists and loopholes. And in part, paradoxically, because it's, they wanted to, because it's so riddled, we may see more radical forms taking place just out of the pain that the kind of shenanigans of the financial sector produce. Folks may just take, as they say, the government actually had enough share of ownership, and had they turned it into voting stock, and it would have already been a public corporation.
We're just at the end, and I'm really sorry that I haven't given you the opportunity to talk a little bit about an example of this democratizing of capital that you write about in the book. And if people want to find out more, they can look at America Beyond Capitalism. Is it possible in about a minute or a minute and a half just to mention real quick an example?
Well, this is probably the most interesting example is in Cleveland, where the process has gone further, and somebody's going to do more than Cleveland. There's a complex of worker-owned cooperatives established already in Cleveland, and they're not just trying to make a few workers rich. They're linked together with a nonprofit corporation and a revolving fund, so they pay back to the center, and then they set up more corporations. And they're aiming partly at the hospitals and universities that buy $3 billion in goods and services in their area. So they're saying, hey, buy from us. They haven't been buying from them at all. And the hospital has been willing to do it, a lot of public money in universities and hospitals. So they're buying from these folks, and they're trying to rebuild the community. So it's a very interesting development. There's a solar, partly solar, hydroponic greenhouse capable of producing 3 million heads of lettuce a year. These are not little tiny things. There's a solar installation company, worker-owned co-op, which is on track to build more more solar capacity than exists in the entire state already. There's another one, probably the greenest laundry in all of the Midwest, that uses about a third of the hot water and the heating, water and heat. That's operating, worker co-op. And they're on track to put on two new ones each year. And it's very interesting because it's community building, linked co-ops. It's not just making a couple folks rich, but also using the purchasing power of these, so they call them anchor institutions, universities and hospitals, that just don't get up and move. And why not use some of that purchasing power to improve the tax base, help the small businessmen in the area? And it has very interesting, in the politics of it, it's very interesting. It's bipartisan. Small business guys like it. The labor people like it. The local activists, radicals, and liberals and conservatives see, hey, it's very practical, building in the community, changing who owns it in a very democratic way. And it's a kind of model to say, hey, the old categories at the local level, they just disappear if you do it the right way. And I think that's another example in Cleveland. You'll find it on that website, community-wealth.org, okay, or in America Beyond Capitalism.
Well, and if you'd like to read the book, America Beyond Capitalism, it's out now. It's published by Democracy Collaborative Press by our guest, Gar Alprovitz. He's professor of political economy at University of Maryland. His last name is spelled Alprovitz, if you're going to go looking for the book. And thanks very much for giving us some of your time.
Great. Appreciate it. Thank you.